So this is monochromatic light. This is a soap film a couple of microns thick, flowing downward. There's no difficulty in poking a rigid object through the film. And this is if you wet it first. If you don't wet it, the film will break. But if you wet it first, there's a 2-millimeter rod poked through the film, and you see a von Karman vortex street generated by the by this rod. Now, clearly, the system is not two-dimensional because what you're looking at is fluctuations in thickness. It's driven by gravity only, retarded somewhat by air friction. You're looking at thickness fluctuations, but it turns out, because this is a reflection off the front and the back face that produces this interference pattern, we have argued, I don't know whether it's really true or not, but we have argued that the thickness behaves like a passive scalar at very large Reynolds numbers, at a high enough Reynolds number, and with a damping term that goes as the square of the Laplacian rather than the Laplacian, because Darcy's law is obeyed in this thin film. But the thickness fluctuations other people have measured is only about 15%. This is the same picture, but instead of having one rod, there are a whole chain of them. There's a cone with a spacing of several millimeters, about 3 millimeters. And there you see the interaction of all of these vortex chains producing what may pass for turbulence. Oh, that's the mean flow speed. Yes, the gravity is driving the flow, and it's somewhat surprising that, the flow is very fast. The flow ultimately reaches the terminal velocity because of air friction. It hasn't... No, it doesn't break. The film will last for hours and hours. It doesn't break. Yes, there's a supply at the top. As I'll show you in a minute. I'll show you in a minute the supply. It sometimes lasts for minutes and minutes instead of hours and hours. Here's what a soap film is like. It's surfactant molecules at a level about 2%, 1% Dawn soap. The molecules have tails that hate water. But the concentration of this of these soap molecules is higher than the critical micellar concentration, which just means that you got some left over in the middle. They're crammed as close as they would like to be on the surface. You still have some left over in the middle, and of course we don't know too much about what's going on in here. But there are these micelles, and they're sort of spherical in this kind of soap, with other kinds of surfactant molecules, you can make them in forms of sausage. Now, as people interested in fluid dynamics are interested in the Reynolds number, but alas, the Reynolds number is not so easy to determine. And why is that? The hard part is the viscosity. The viscosity consists of a surface term and a volume term. It's been conjectured that they can be added together, but it's very difficult to determine just what the viscosity is. 10 times the viscosity of water, I think, is an absolute upper limit. Other people have chosen a third of that, 0.03 centimeters squared per second. The Reynolds numbers are quite modest. That's the Reynolds number based on the 3 or 4 millimeter spacing of the tines in this comb. I'm just going to be talking about the tines in the comb, except for one transparency that will appear in a moment. Now you can see how this apparatus is made. Kids can make it. You have fishing lines. Here's a container of fluid. What's not shown is a valve that controls the flow out of this container of 2% Dawn soap onto this soap film. and it goes into a container at the bottom. It's easy to lift there's a weight down here that holds the thing taut. So you can make these two fishing lines. You can make your film parallel over a very large distance. And it's easy. It's so large, as a matter of fact, that even if you're a mere 6 feet tall, you can make this film much, much higher than that. You do it in the following way: you lift the these fishing lines off the hook. So now you have two fishing lines like this, and the fluid is dribbling down here. You open up the valve to what it is, and then you put threads on these things and put them back on the hooks. So you can make these things five stories high without any trouble, and we have a physics building five stories high, and you can on a weekend when people don't keep opening the door, you can make the flow from top to bottom something like a meter per second. Okay, now the measurements are made by a laser Doppler velocimetry. Which is, we don't need to care too much about that. Two coherent beams intersect, forming a patch, and particles dart through this fringes, optical fringes, you know the spacing of the fringes, so you can determine the velocity. You have to seed this thing, and you may want to seed it with particles that are less than 2 microns, so they don't stick out the sides. But that poses no difficulty. Incidentally, you can easily pump the fluid back up, so you can make this thing go on forever. An hour is sort of forever, then something happens and it breaks. So that's the equipment. Mischer gave a talk last week about the effect of a polymer in the experiment that Victor Steinberg did. Here you can see the same thing. This is the same vortex street. I won't return to this vortex street, but I thought it might be fun to mention in light of his talk. Here's 0 parts per million of a polymer additive. If you add a polymer at a concentration of 30 parts per million, this is a high molecular weight polymer, about 5 million. The thickness, as I've already said, is a couple of microns. This is a flow of 1.7 meters per second in this direction. You clearly completely change the structure. The soap film has a polymer added. There's still 2% soap and 30 parts per million polymer. And you can see this effect down to even smaller concentrations. Victor Steinberg's experiments that we heard about were at 80 parts per million. An interesting question is, what does the polymer do as far as, say, the frequency of the shedding? Does it shift it up? Does it shift it down? Does it change the amplitude? What goes on? Well, we tried to study that, but I won't. I just wanted to show you that you can study the effect of a polymer additive in a soap film. But this talk is about our measurements of the third moment. In a soap film, we also have to measure the second moment, but our prime interest is the third moment. There are many authors of this paper that we published. Martin Rutgers designed this apparatus that we can make five stories high or a couple of meters high, which is the way it is in our lab, meter and a half. But most of this work was done by Andrew Belmonte. And I talked with Andrew on the phone a lot because he called me up to tell me that he won a Sloan Fellowship last week, and he sends his best regards to you. They worked in the same lab. Um, before he came to Pittsburgh. All of these guys are scattered far and wide, except my colleague, my Shaolin Wu, with whom I work closely and always learn things from. There's the third moment, the usual expression for the third moment, derived first by Kolmogorov. And the nth moment is the longitudinal moment that we're talking about. And the as far as this term is concerned, the if you go to two dimensions, this four-fifths is changed to three-halves. And the energy injection rate is dv squared dt with a minus sign. Yes, but this is the way I'll define it. And we'll see. This is the way I'll define epsilon. Well, no, but we can use whatever definition. I'll just stick with this definition. And pardon me? I just. Yeah, well, yeah. We're going to see, to tell you what we'll see in advance, we'll see that S3 of R spends a little of its, a little R being negative and a lot of R being positive. That's the end result of this experiment. And amongst the quantities that we measure are the velocity correlation function, which is just a piece, the cross term in the second moment. And of course, this is just related to the second moment, the second order structure factor. In this fashion, I'm defining V as the component that we measure, and which is in the vertical direction. Now, the experiment makes heavy use of the frozen turbulence assumption. So it seemed worthwhile to check the frozen turbulence assumption. And you saw in that slide that I had earlier, we had two laser Doppler velocimeter heads, and we could vary their separation. So we could make measurements with one probe, and then we could make measurements with two probe, avoiding the frozen turbulence assumption, and see how thing and see if we got the same result. The solid circles show the fourth moment measured with the frozen turbulence assumption, and the squares show the measurements without it. So the thing works very well, and if I'd shown you the sixth moment, it would be just as good. Moments higher than that, the agreement is not so good. The frozen turbulence assumption is that these small-scale eddies are just transported downward without decaying before your observation point. So we have this eddy here going like this, and this is the observation point with this laser Doppler velocimeter. I'm just using distance is equal to velocity times time, and I'm assuming that the eddy isn't changing as it passes by. See, the mean speed is very fast, and this is an assumption that works when the mean speed is very when the mean flow speed is very fast. Yes, it's about 7% or something like that. Yeah, right. Because we measured them. They just don't lie. I've forgotten to tell you the truth. They don't lie. The white squares don't lie right on the black circles. Yeah, I think you'd be surprised that it would help for very high moments. Yeah. And I think it's a concern. It's a concern for all the higher moment measurements, and it's worth checking this frozen turbulence assumption. For us it was, because no such measurements exist in such a system.
I'm just trying to get a physical basis for the breakdown. Is it random phase fluctuation in the LDA signal itself? Certainly,
for example, for electrification,
it just falls apart as it passes the observation point. And you're sensitive at higher moments, you're sensitive to very small changes. But we're looking at the wings here.
I'm glad.
I'm glad I showed that transparency. Now, the measurements that I'm going to describe were made about 8 centimeters below the grid. That's not an important thing. We're out of the way where you can see the individual eddies, where the eddies are combining with each other, so the turbulence tends to be more isotropic. Incidentally, this laser Doppler velocimeter that we have, and most people have this kind, uses as a laser source a laser of many colors, several colors. So with two colors, you can measure the transverse fluctuations and the longitudinal fluctuations, and those, and in the range of the data that I'll show, those two, the flow is rather isotropic. So that's what the turbulence looks like visually. Those are the thickness fluctuations, 8 centimeters below, and we'll be varying this position below the comb Y, but just a little bit. Here's the energy spectrum measured in our soap film at 8 centimeters below the comb. And, we know we have a very modest Reynolds number. And this slope that we can extract, roughly a decade or so, is 3.3. Now, if this were a spectrum in the entropy cascade region, this would be minus 3. And now there is some numerical work in which one sees a number here that's a little bit larger than 3. And I'm sure there are people in this room who know whether this is... I'd say our measurements could encompass 3, but they tend to be on the high side. And I don't know whether there's physics associated with this 0.3. And maybe people will tell me about that. But anyway, that's the energy spectrum. One over this is the sort of the spacing of the, and this is in centimeters, so 4/10 of a centimeter would be about 2.5 out here. In other words, the reciprocal of 0.4. But I never know whether to divide by 2 pi or pi or nothing there. I never know what to do. Now, we'll be looking at eddies much larger than this, than the spacing between the teeth, because 4 millimeters.
That's a half wavelength. Just trying to calibrate what that corresponds to.
Well, the reciprocal of 0.4 is 2.5, but this has the 2 pi in here, so it's somewhere out here. These are no larger. These are larger. And most of the effects that we'll see are at large scales. Yes, they're obtained by just straightaway measurement of the RMS fluctuations, which is comparable to integrating the spectrum. That's right. Exactly so. I'm sorry, I can't... Well, the RMS includes, it would be the integral. The means, What you mean? In other words, are you speaking of the sweeping of the sweeping past of the? This high wave number tail. Yes. Well, no. None of the things that I'm going to talk about utilize measurements of the spectrum. Or utilize the RMS.
Yeah, but the RMS is whether you like it or not, the RMS is an
integral. Yes.
It doesn't matter. When you measure.
They're comparable. They're comparable.
You're essentially measuring the integral under the spectrum. I mean, but that's what I'm saying. That thing goes down very, very, very slowly. The question is what's the bandwidth?
Yeah. I'll learn from you when we can talk about that. Well, we're down to a rather small number. It's about fit. Well, it depends on how you measure the compressibility, but the guys who measured it at Los Alamos said it's about 15% compressible. It's about, yeah, that's right. It's the variation of the thickness about 15%. Yes, no, I know that. Oh no, I know that.
And it usually gives you another skill.
I would enjoy talking with you about this. These measurements were made with films in which the mean thickness was about 2 microns, and the compressibility is about 15%. You can make the films very thick by tilting this apparatus. You lose speed, but you can make them very thick. You can make them 10 and 20 microns. And then the fluctuational changes are much smaller. The fractional change in the thickness is much smaller. No, I haven't. I only know of slow measurements, and I don't know of spectra. They did, yeah. They don't alter. Right. They measure the thickness. They put milk in the. Instead of putting particles, they put milk in the soap solution. So now the milk was sufficiently dense that by passing light through the film, they could directly measure the thickness variations. No, it's time to go further? Okay. Okay, now there's the third moment that we measure. At small r, presumably it's negative, and then but there's no question about the fact. I think incidentally, these results were sufficiently curious to us that my co-authors who had left, one went to France and the other went to Ohio State, repeated them at those respective places, and they see that these results they reproduce these results in their own laboratories. So it's negative ever so slightly, you can see from the expanded view, spends most of its time being positive, and decays. It decays to zero when the length scales are so long that you can factor the delta V cubed into two pieces that average to zero. So I don't know whether other people see a third moment out to such large values of point separation R that they can see this decline to zero. I have not seen such measurements, but we have no trouble seeing this fall to zero. Oh yeah, now I'm going to discuss that. What is L naught? Well, from the velocity correlation function normalized, one obtains what is usually called the outer scale of the turbulence. And so L zero is the outer scale of the turbulence. This was obtained with one anemometer. Once we found that we seemed to be all right with this frozen turbulence assumption. So this is an important number to keep in mind. Incidentally, I'm not all that far from the end. I've shown you the main observation, our central observation. This thing changes sign. Keep in mind that this energy injection rate obtained by setting it equal to that VRMS cubed over L0, it's about 10 to the fourth. So I'll compare another number with that 10 to the 4th to show what I think are internal consistency of the measurements. So now the question is, can we explain this positive swing? What does explain mean? Well, now I've written out an equation that's equally correct for the third moment, as I wrote before. It contains an additional effect that for force turbulence would not be present. There's a term representing the decay with time of B. Yeah, for stationary turbulence. For stationary turbulence, that term wouldn't be there, but it's certainly there for our decaying turbulence. And whereas this is apparently very small in three dimensions, it's measurable in two dimensions, and is responsible, I think, for the positive swing in S3. So we need to know dBdt, because we will not ignore it. And we'll use the frozen turbulence assumption. And we'll make these observations at two values of y and see how a change in B is produced by a change in y. And then with this frozen turbulence assumption, we've got this term. And I remarked here that in 3D, this term is dropped, say, in the derivation of Landau and Lifshitz. Which is a derivation that is concerned with decaying turbulence, whereas in Frisch's book, the derivation that he carries out is for forced turbulence. So, forgetting this term, S3 is just found by integrating this expression. And that's what you get. I think I should have written that outside there, because it's just the mean velocity. And how could this thing swing positive? If at time t, or at position y, B looked like this, and at time t plus delta t, that is, you go down a little distance delta y, which was 2 millimeters in our case, it looked like this, then for small r, and then there's this additional rapidly rising function r cubed, then for small r, this thing would have to be negative. But this thing, if this thing just crossed with this high points heavily weighted by this rapidly rising r cubed thing here, this term could get a lot of weight and cause a switch. Yeah, that's right. Right, that's what we're seeing. So it would be nice if B at y is equal to 8 centimeters and say y is equal to 8.2 centimeters really did show this effect. And it does. There's B. As a function of r, and here's this crossover. Here is sort of expanded here, that's what we claim. And I only have one or two more transparencies to show. Is responsible. We measure dBdt. That is, we measure delta b over delta y. And so we can calculate the right-hand side of that previous equation and see if it's equal to S3. And here's the same old S3 that I showed before, admittedly only out to 2 centimeters. Keep in mind that the outer scale is here, 0.6 centimeters. And this is obtained by integrating the correlation function with that R cubed weighting factor. And well, considering that we don't have perfectly isotropic turbulence, and perhaps the problems that you raise, I call that good agreement. Others may call it poor agreement. In any case, that's what we get. So the measurements in that sense are internally consistent. I was integrating this equation dp dt times r cubed dr from 0 to r. Well, listen, I was so pleased that I had any understanding of why this thing was swinging positive that...
why is it swinging positive? Just the increase in my field of the opposite, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yes.
Incidentally, I think most laboratories have the same problem.
I see. Well, you know, I didn't know that. And do they ignore it or include it?
I think what everybody tries to fit here is for which the film is supposed to be.
But this is
3 minutes. I'm saying even in 3 minutes, it's present.
Yeah.
All the DNA.
So it's much bigger than 2.
Absolutely.
Is it seen in.
It's not the equilibrium rate hasn't pulled away from the other thing. You don't really have.
Well, in other words, you're surprised that the agreement is between those two curves is not that great.
The two you showed earlier.
Yeah, the data and the. Incidentally, there's the third moment and the absolute third moment. This is the third moment on the top and the absolute third moment on the bottom. They clearly don't look at all alike.
Looking with the absolute third moment doesn't change sign.
Right, that's right. It doesn't change sign. It doesn't change sign. But it, aside from that, it has features that are very different.
There are very delicate constellations in this third moment, in the real third moment. There is a model of the moment.
Yes. Yes.
The upper flow is very difficult to explain, but the bigger she can explain, and she will not
explain.
Yeah, yeah. So, were you measuring, using trackers or counters?
We use a counter device, yeah. Well, no, it was a TSI machine. Yeah, it's a counter. No, everything is done digitally in the machine. It's a digital device.
I know.
Yeah, I'm sure. No, it's just a recent vintage of a TSI machine. Now. Yes. Yes, sir, we had to do that. Now, what about the probability density functions? Well, here are probability density functions at three different values of R. And, Grisha, I think you said something in your talk that suggests that that you would be surprised to see exponential flanks on this probability density function of a very small scale. This is very small scale. This is 0.1 millimeters. And then you can see this is 1 millimeter, and this is 5 millimeters. And you can extract the kurtosis or the flatness from these data. You can watch it smoothly change from 6 to 3, which is what it should go from an exponential to a to the galaxy. Oh. Oh, I see. Then maybe it was someone else. Pardon me? Is this what you would expect in 2D turbulence or not? Victor said that this should be exponential if the turbulence were forced, but he didn't know what it was if the turbulence were decaying. Incidentally, these are measurements made that you'll see these measurements in Frisch's book. These measurements were made without the frozen turbulence assumption at Princeton by Dick Miles. And again, at very small scales, this is 28 microns, one sees these exponential tanks. This is 3D turbulence. Yeah, right. So he isn't using the frozen turbulence assumption. He can. That's right. He only measures the transverse fluctuations from regional. Yes, he gets his. Our data are Gaussian. You can see this curve change smoothly.
How many sigmas you can? How long can go to the tail?
Several sigmas, but I have to go back and do this. Because this is the RMS velocity fluctuation. This is not the mean velocity, root mean square velocity fluctuation on a scale R. Well, I mean, we're down here in Torr noise. I'm sorry. I'm not sure. Just which.
At large scale.
Oh yeah, the data fit the Gaussian function. Give a kurtosis of 3. There, on an appropriate plot, you get a straight line.
It's
the yes, you know, we haven't paid much attention to that, and we could pay attention to that. We can make measurements that we haven't made. We can, the large scales are easy. We can certainly look at fluctuation. We can certainly look, I think, rather far down. So this is a summary that's hardly necessary since these questions have already summarized what I said. The eddies combine to form large structures. Incidentally, this outer scale L0 grows with time, grows with distance, that is, down the stream. And you've seen this positive swing in S3, which we think has to do with this decay. And I just mentioned in passing the exponential flux on the decaying turbulence PDFs at very small scales. And that's it. No, I showed you one measurement at three distant points, but we haven't done what you suggest. Well, we can do these. These measurements aren't that hard. But we need some guidance, I think, to go further about what measuring the right things. I'm sorry. You're not speaking of the bending of the film, are you? The there is an instability. In fact, the maximum speed we contain is about 4 meters a second, because the film will rupture just because of this instability that you mentioned. Yes, in other words, the system. Well, you see, it's gravity, but I'll tell you, at 8 centimeters, this film has not reached its terminal velocity. Even at a meter, it hasn't. At 2 or 3 meters, it has. But certainly not, and we're at 8 centimeters. We're measuring 8 centimeters below. If we go too far below, we don't have so much turbulence left. You mean the fluid is constantly gaining kinetic energy from the gravitational field? Okay. My pleasure.